to introduce or present Dr. Henry Rowald, who is Asian strategy, mission planner, whatever. So like the challenge of, for example, trying to devise mission strategy for working in a country that you can't get really anybody into. And how do we do mission under those, you know, conditions of closed countries and the like. But to present via slides and just informal sort of presentation, what's happening in that area of the world today, and what the prospects are for opportunities for effective mission in China. A quarter of the world's population Chinese. We can't do mission and ignore that fact. That's for sure. So, Henry.
Just a week and a half or so ago, I was in a meeting in San Francisco with those pastors that are called by our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod for what they call ethnic ministries here. It involves Chinese, Hmong, Lao, Korean, Japanese, Oriental, Far Eastern ministries. And you get talking with these people, and it doesn't take very long to find out that, boy, we're just involved in the same ballgame. And this world is so small and it's shrinking so fast that we've got to think of ministry in global terms, and not just in terms of what we are here and what they are over there, because we're all in it together. The ministry that I have been involved in I graduated here in 64, and that makes it 64, 87, 23 years, minus the year of graduate work, 22 years of work in Chinese language ministries. Most of those years in Taiwan, which is part of China, and the last 3 years have been in Hong Kong, although my ministry there has not been primarily a ministry within Hong Kong. It has been a matter of living in Hong Kong and working in Hong Kong, and I got an office there, but really it's a matter of working out of Hong Kong as much as in Hong Kong. And my assignment has been specifically one, as Professor Kapitsky mentioned, of reaching out to those areas, those countries that have, to one extent or another, closed themselves off to the traditional forms of mission work. In specific terms, that has involved Burma, Thailand, three or four different kinds of ministry in Thailand, Indonesia, and China. And China is what we're going to be talking about tonight. In fact, about a half year or so ago, the Board for Mission Services decided to establish a China Coordinating Center, which in one sense doesn't mean a whole lot, because all it says is that I should be paying more attention to China. On the other hand, it means a whole lot, because what it says is that as a mission board, it wants to be paying more attention to China. And it feels that China is a place that we got to be concerned with and we got to be in touch with. And it has kind of added that to the portfolio that I carry. So in terms of the future direction of my work, it's going to be looking more and more toward China, which is, as far as I'm concerned, the finest culture that there is in the world, one of the richest and one of the fullest cultures that there could possibly be, and God has blessed the Chinese people so much with what they have been given, and it's my blessing to have this kind of assignment. On the other hand, it's a little bit intimidating, because when you talk China, you're talking about 1 billion people. Now, in the States here, we talk maybe, what, 300 million, something like that? Whatever. 1 billion people is just a lot of people. And the situation that the church has to work under there is a very difficult one. The situation that the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has to work under is even more difficult, because the church in China is a little bit suspicious of anything Western. Now, we're not going to be talking too much about those things tonight, unless you want to bring them up in terms of questions and answers. because in our convocation, when is that, Charlie? 9th of December. I have given myself the assignment of sharing some aspects of the life of the church in China, what it's all about, where it's at, how it's gotten where it is, and what are some of the problems and so on, and we're going to be spending some time talking in detail about that. Tonight's going to be a little more of a general introduction to China, to the culture there, to the people, to the context in which the church has to operate. And I think that's all I'm going to say for now. We're going to look at some slides, unless you have questions. Otherwise, I invite questions at any point during the slides, and we'll have some time afterwards to talk together, too. All right. I have been into China three times now, two times on formal tours, and one time for 2 weeks on my own, just kind of rummaging around. One of the places that everyone gets to in China is the Great Wall up around the Beijing area, and that's what you see here. Those who have said those things say that the Great Wall is the one man-made monument visible from outer space. Now, that really says something. Not talking Washington Monument, you're not talking, you know, Lincoln Memorial or anything. The Great Wall. And it really is a magnificent thing. I think the next slide will also show us some of the Great Wall. They built it to keep the barbarians from the north away from the Chinese to the south. It was a good idea. It was a good idea. And the thing goes for about 3,000 miles. That's the thing. 3,000 miles, and it goes about 20 feet high and wide enough to hold about two chariots or so, you know, at one time. 10 feet, 12 feet, whatever it is. I don't know how many bricks that makes, but it is one pile of bricks. It really is. The thing is, though, that at the same time, it is one of the greatest tributes to futility that there could be, because what happened, well, let me just point out here. Here we have one of the outposts here, one of the places where people, the soldiers would stay, and here's one down here. They situated these in a very scientific way, and the distance between this and this is the distance that someone here could shoot an arrow, and someone here could shoot an arrow. In other words, they could safeguard this whole passage in between these two places here with, you know, the distance of an arrow. The thing they did not, however, take into account was the fact that those people that shoot the arrows could be bribed. And what happened was that, you know, the whole thing was left intact, but when the enemy came, they just kind of sidled up to these guys up here on the top and bribed them, and the gates were open, and they went on through. Terrible. A monument to human sinfulness and human greed. All right, enough said. A lovely thing, though. It has been in existence for, gosh, 1,500 years anyhow. It was built in different stages, and here we see some of the problems that it has suffered. Really, most of the damage has been very recent, and that is because China has been such a poor nation in terms of material goods, that what happened was that both the army and the ordinary population would simply come and dismantle the wall. They'd just tear it down, and they'd go take the bricks, and they'd go off somewhere and build themselves some barracks or some homes or whatever. But nonetheless, it is just a lovely, beautiful structure. All right. This is in Beijing, the capital city, Peking, as we used to know it by. This is the imperial city. This was the city where the emperors, dating from about 1400 or so, in other words, before Martin Luther, where they took up their residence and lived in continuously ever since. And the city just really is a... These buildings here are more recent. They're Communist Party buildings. But
is it all planned?
It's all planned.
It's very planned.
Oh, yeah. All planned. The thing is that in the Imperial City, once you were in, you never got out. And if you were out, you never got in. and there was death penalty no matter which direction you went. And now it has been turned into a museum, and they call it that, the ancient museum. But it is a lovely, beautiful place. Gosh. No, Marco Polo was much earlier. He was before Columbus, a couple hundred years, as a matter of fact. This goes to about 1400 or so when it was first started, the Ming Dynasty. Okay. And a couple of shots from the inside here. About 1920 or so, people just were not allowed in here at all. 1911 was the time of the revolution in China when Sun Yat-sen led his revolution, and then it became a democratic nation. And after a few years later, then it became open, and now it has become a museum. This is kind of a traditional sort of a guardian animal, a devil dog or a lion, however you want to characterize it. All right? Oh, this is lovely. This is a piece of rock, a marble. Piece of marble that measures, I don't know how many, 200 tons or something like that. Monster, 60 feet long, monstrous thing. The emperor, of course, commissioned this, and he wanted it carved, and you got the dragons here and the waves and so on. He wanted this carved, and he wanted it brought up to the imperial palace. Now, the thing is, how do you cart something that is 200 tons when you don't have semis and whatever else that you have anymore today. So the Chinese, being the smart and very adaptable people they were, simply put the emperor off until it was winter time. And what they did before winter was to cut themselves a kind of a canal, hundreds and hundreds of miles of canal, and then they flooded it with water and waited for winter. And then the water froze, and then they took this thing and just dragged it along up to Peking and put it in place. The Chinese are lovely people. All right.
One solid piece of marble?
One solid piece. One piece, indeed. Yeah. Unbelievable. Now, this is in the big square in front of the Imperial Palace. This is the Great Hall of the People, which is what we'd call a Congress, I guess, of the United States, comparable to that, where you have the legislative body that meets here and a lot of other auditoriums and so on that can meet here. I think it's billed as the largest single square, open-air square in the world. Okay. And the day we were there, they were honoring someone or other that was in town. I don't know who it was, some head of some state or other. But I took it to show the troops that were here and the flags and so on and the ceremony that's important to the Chinese people there. All right. This is the Temple of Heaven, so-called. Temple of Heaven goes back, hundreds and hundreds of years. And this was a temple that only the emperor would come to, and he would come here on behalf of the people and as a representative of the people in order at New Year's Day, Chinese New Year, Lunar New Year's Day, in order to give prayer on behalf of the people for good harvest, good weather, good crops for the people. And it's just a lovely, beautiful building. All right. This is part of the Imperial Palace, also called really the Summer Palace. Long walkway on a lakeside here. It goes for a couple of miles, and up here on the individual beams and on the sides are depicted different scenes from the various stories and novels and myths or whatever of China that are important. Okay. And this is also in Peking, on a lake, as you can see. This was back around the turn of into the 20th century, actually. The Empress at that time. This was the time when the Western nations were making such terrific inroads into China and such demands on China, and Chinese were becoming very impatient with the Western nations, feeling that they were really being imposed on. What the Empress did was to take the budget that had been allotted to the Navy and build for herself a marble boat. And this is it. This is the result of that year's budget of the naval forces, and she built herself this marble boat that sits out here, and it's kind of a restaurant now and a testimony to corruption is what it is. I mean, it's a lovely thing, you know, it really is, although it's really kind of a shame. Well, whatever, go on. This is on the road out to the burial grounds, and these are some of the guardian warriors and figures of history that kind of keep the burial grounds sacred, all right? And this is part of that. Really, the burial grounds in this area is up here. This is a kind of a museum or a memorial mausoleum or something built in honor of the emperors. The thing is that the emperor and his empress and a few others of the royal family have been buried about 70 to 80 feet below this. And only about, 8-9 years ago did they discover the fact that there was a burial ground there, a tomb. And it really was an important discovery because they were able to learn more about what life was like back in the times that this emperor was from than they had ever learned before, and it was really an important kind of a discovery here. Okay. Now, this is a little more modern kind of thing. This is a major hotel in the central city of Nanjing. Nanking, as it used to be called. 36-story building with a revolving restaurant up on top. This is a place where most Westerners who come to Nanjing stay. Lovely place. The thing that's really a little bit depressing is that when you come out from this hotel, you see the Chinese who are standing there just really with their mouths open because they've never seen a building. This is the tallest building in China. They're just kind of standing, they've never seen a building that tall before and could not realize, could not imagine that anyone would want to stay in a building that tall. But it is a lovely building. That also symbolizes the fact that China is beginning with Japanese and American and European and Canadian cooperation, really beginning to go into a lot of this kind of joint effort to develop the tourism industry there. All right. This is one of the most moving things I ever saw in China. What you see here is the Yangtze River. In Chinese, it's simply called the Long River. It is, I think, ranked the number 4 river in the world in terms of, length or amount of water that flows through the shores or something. The thing is that at the time, I guess it was shortly after World War II, the Chinese talked with engineers from just a number of Western nations to see about building a bridge across this river because you got to be able to unite southern China with northern China. And they all said, no, it can't be done. And so what the Chinese did was to build it themselves. They just went out and did it. You got a bunch of coolies out there and a bunch of bricks and stuff and steel, and they did it. And somehow it has managed to stay. And it's a bridge that is well over a mile long here and goes all the way down here and then back again, and down below is a railroad track, up above is road for vehicles and bicycles and so on. Really is a moving thing. Okay. This is another one of those moving things in China. The Great Canal links Peking in the north with some of the central cities in China, about 1,000 miles long or so, kind of like building a canal from, St. Louis to New Orleans, or maybe even more than that, I don't know. Kind of one of those things that only an emperor can say, hey, we want a canal. You know, you guys build it, and they do it. And the thing is that it works, and it's really used to this day. And a lot of people, like you see on this picture and the next one too, live their lives completely on the canal. They just really never get off the boats, except, of course, to buy a little food now and again. All right, next picture will show that. These it almost looks like a locomotive or a train or something. Just kind of goes along thousands and thousands of miles, takes grain up north and brings the coal and the other minerals and so on down south. Impressive thing. All right, that goes back 1,000 years plus. This was taken for a couple of reasons. One is to introduce the next few slides that are coming, which center around this structure up here, which is a mausoleum of Sun Yat-sen, who is the George Washington of China, the man who instituted democratic rule in China. He is a man revered both by the Chinese in Taiwan and the Chinese in the mainland. Now, the other reason I took it, though, is to show dress on the part of the people here. This obviously is a soldier, and you can see his normal kind of uniform here. You can also see that most of the women, and you don't see too many of them here, all wear slacks. It's only in very recent times, like in the last year or two, that you see women in significant numbers wearing skirts instead of slacks. Otherwise, it's mostly slacks. Here you see the normal kind of what's called the Mao suit. Otherwise, pretty drab, colorless kinds of clothes, but very functional. Okay, now we'll move up to that museum. About 300 and whatever steps it is to get up there. Really a lovely, lovely place, okay? This is a statue. It kind of reminds you of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C. Marble statue of Sun Yat-sen here, and different things inscribed on the walls around. The next picture, I think, if I remember right, go ahead, is the interesting one. Yeah. This is taken of the ceiling up above the area where he is buried. What this is the nationalist emblem, the logo of the Chinese Nationalist Party, which is the party of Chiang Kai-shek, the party that now has been moved to Taiwan. What really impressed me was the fact that the communists in China would allow that to exist. You know, they had their great cultural revolution and all of those kinds of things, which were the most rigorous kind of revolution that there could be, and somehow they managed to allow this to exist. I don't know why. I almost felt guilty looking up there and taking a picture of it. But it is also a symbol of the fact that China is really changing and is really opening up. And it's opening itself up to Taiwan, and it's opening itself up to the world in ways that no one could have imagined even 5 years ago. And this is kind of a symbol of that. All right. This is Shanghai, one of the biggest cities in China, not necessarily the biggest. Has only about 10 million people or so. 10 million people. Yeah, Berg, right. Missouri as a state has, I don't know what it has. I think it's less than 10 million as a state. I was in North Dakota a few weeks ago, a month ago. The state, total state of North Dakota has 682,700 people. Shanghai has 10 million. Unreal. Modern city that is trying to get itself back on its feet again in terms of economy, in terms of all aspects of life. And the satellite dishes here are kind of a symbol of that, and the pollution too. All right. This is taken from that big hotel that we saw before, taken down to the street. And here you can see how the ordinary people live, and it's a very jumbled, a very close kind of life, very low-level kind of life. The buildings that are there for the ordinary people, apartment buildings and so on, may go up to maybe 10 stories, 12 stories, something like that, but really not much more than that. Otherwise, you've got what you have here. And I think the next picture shows the same kind of thing. All right, this is not the one I was thinking of, but this is in Chongqing, which is a city in the far interior of China, a much poorer, more backward city than Shanghai. But same kind of thing, just building, fitted on building, on building, on building. All right, see what the next one shows. Doesn't show what I was looking for. This is Shanghai again. A couple of things really stand out. One thing is, notice how many cars there are. There's one. And the normal means of locomotion is by foot. People, this is one of the, in terms of, let's say, 50 years ago, one of the great boulevards of history. Shanghai really ranked, really it was more important than Hong Kong or any of the other places in Asia. This is one of the great boulevards of history. Shopping areas and department stores and all kinds of things. And it still is in China. It's just that it has regressed a bit. Now, the other thing that's interesting in this picture is you see skirts here. One, two, three, and maybe more. I don't know. But you also see colors that I did not see the first time I was in China. There's some yellow, and here's some yellow, and here's some pink, and here's some red, and a few other colors scattered around. China is beginning to move. Okay. This is an apartment building taken. One of the reasons I took it is to show how they dry their clothes. They don't have dryers, obviously. And so what they do is they take a big bamboo pole, and they run that bamboo pole through one arm and through, out the other arm, and then stick it out the window. And the wind isn't going to blow the clothes away then, you know, and that's the way they dry their clothes. Now, the other thing about these apartment buildings is that they are really run by what are called in China a unit. A unit is basically an economic unit, ordinarily a factory or a school or some other economic unit of production. And that unit controls who works there, it controls where they live, it controls a good bit of their life, when they can get married and how many kids they can have. The government controls that. When they can have the one kid that they can have, and who gets the bicycles that are allotted to the unit that year, and all kinds of things like that. And this whole building then would belong to some factory or some unit or other. Okay. When I was in China, because I can speak the language a little bit, I was able to ride on public transportation, and so I just kind of took this picture of a bus. Raised the camera up and just took unbelievable pressure of people when you got 1 billion of them. They have in one sense they have solved one of the great problems of life, and that is, how do you deal without privacy? How do you live, you know, crunched in? And they've done that, and I think they have something to teach the rest of the world that way. They and the Japanese and Koreans and a few others. All right. This was taken at a hospital in China. You can see here she's got something sticking out. It's not some hairs that are growing out there. That's an acupuncture needle. She's got one coming out here. She's got one coming out here. She's got one coming out here. And maybe a few others. I don't know. But there is a whole medical tradition in China, which is not Western medicine, it's Eastern medicine. And it deals with, in terms of medicines that are prescribed, it's herbal medicine as opposed to what we call out of a, you know, regular prescription medicine. And in terms of treatment, it's not operations, which they call very radical surgery. It's really something you do only in a very last resort kind of a situation, but rather it is acupuncture. Now, acupuncture works on the premise that there is in the body, in addition to the air system and the blood system, there is another system that operates, which is, I don't know what we'd call it, the system of... the vital force, I guess is the word that you'd say. The vital force that has to be kept open. And what happens ordinarily when that gets blocked up is that you have pain of one kind or another. And therefore the way to treat pain is to open up those vital forces. And that's what these needles are for. It's to get into those areas where things get clogged up. And you get in there and you kind of work that needle around, and sometimes you heat it, and sometimes you really build it up to a significant amount of heat, and you open that up so that the vital force can flow again. I had that once on myself, acupuncture. I had sprained my knee. I don't know what I was doing, playing tennis or something or other, some kind of athletic something or other, and the knee really kind of ballooned up. And living just behind me was a Chinese doctor. He had been trained in Western medicine, but also in Chinese medicine. And he took a look at that knee, and he said, well, shoot, easy. All you need is some acupuncture. Come on over. And so I went over and put up my knee there and rolled up the pants leg. And here he comes with those big, long needles. I mean, like so, you know. And he starts twirling those things in there. And I think I had about three or four of those dangling out of my knee. I had my oldest daughter along at the time. She wasn't real old, like about 8 or 9 or something. And it was fun was to watch her eyes just get really big. I mean, big, seeing his needles going in there. But the philosophy was that something was clogged up there, and you got to open it up. And I don't know if it did any good. It didn't do any harm. And he also combined it with the most foul-smelling bunch of garbage that he put on my knee and then wrapped it with a bandage for a couple of days. Whatever. I got over what the problem was. No, it did not hurt. I honestly did not feel those needles going in, and there were three or four of them that he put in. Now, they're very fine, but you can buy, you know, like you can buy for instructional purposes for schools, you know, you can buy skeletons of people, you know, that list the muscles and all that kind of thing. You can buy that kind of thing in China or in Taiwan for these acupuncture points. And they have them all listed, and they go into hundreds. I mean, really, literally hundreds. And those who are expert in the science of acupuncture know where they all are. And he was able to put that needle in at places where it honestly didn't hurt. It didn't draw blood. It didn't draw any pain at all. But it was in there long enough so that if you had hit it, it would whang, 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 whang back and forth. Interesting experience. All right. Next picture shows the pharmacy. This one just really blew me out of the saddle. This is the pharmacy, which shows tree bark, and it shows plants, and it shows mushrooms and all kinds of things there in these great big drawers. But it works, guys. It really, and gal, sorry. It works. It really does work. The thing is that somehow or other, somebody has to be able to understand what's going on in Western medicine and in Eastern medicine and bring the two together so that we can figure out what in the world, you know, in Western terms, we can explain what it is about these medicines that's really effective. Because there's a lot of stuff here that really is for real. All right. Oh, this is fun. This was taken at a little noodle shop close to a hotel where I lived. Noodle shop where they made their own noodles. I'd seen it done once in Hong Kong. Raymond, I'm sure, has seen this before too. It's a performance in Hong Kong, but in China, this is a way of just spending your day. What they do is they take a lump of dough, a glump like this, and then it's about so long, you know, and so big around or so, a glump of dough, and they take that then and they stretch that out. Now they do a lot of kneading and all that kind of thing and stretch it out. And then take that end and bring it over to this end. So they've got two lengths then. And then they stretch that out and then bring that end over here again. And then instead of two, you got four. And you're using your fingers to keep all those separate. And you bring that end over here again and then keep working it out and you've got eight. And you bring that one over here and you've got 16. And I counted it up and they do that 7 times. And by the time they are finished with that one lump of dough, they have noodles that they use and they drop into a pot of boiling water and make noodle soup out of. Instant noodles, but not the ramen kind of noodles, you know, that you buy out of the little plastic, whatever. Instant noodles made on the spot. In Hong Kong, that's a performance. And you clap for these guys and, you know, here it's the way they spend 8 hours of their day, every day of their lives. Unbelievable. This one and the next one shows that. He's twirling it around here, and then he'll come out and stretch it out again and bring it over. Unbelievable. All right. Here's what you do when telephone poles break. All right, next one. This is a vegetable market. This is one of the areas that's a little bit depressing in China because there just is not much good vegetables or fruit available in China. Here are some onions here and some cabbages back here, and I can't really tell what's out here. Maybe some potatoes or something, or I don't know, different kinds of cabbages, whatever. Really not a heck of a lot. And certainly not what I was used to in Taiwan, which is really plush. I mean, it's got everything under the sun all year long. But when you got 1 billion people, what can you do? All right. Now we're heading into the world of religion just a bit. And this one is a transitional one to show that some of what's called the traditional religions are sort of alive in China. We're going to be talking about that at the convocation a little bit more. My impression is that they really are not all that terribly much alive. The temples that I have been in, I observe people using the temples more as museums or as historical curiosities than as places of functioning worship. Just my observation. All right. Now, the rest of the slides really deal more with Christianity. This was a very interesting experience we had. This is a gravestone in the honor of a man by the name of Matteo Ricci. I don't know if the name rings a bell with anyone here. He was a Jesuit priest who went out to China about the time that Luther was still alive. He was one of the first generation Jesuits under Loyola. He and Xavier and a few of the others were that generation. And this man was so great, so gifted, that he made his way not only into China, but into the imperial court of China, and really made a lasting impression on China as a nation. And so the burial place of him and a few of his compatriots in Peking have been left intact. Interesting thing is that they now have been enclosed in a communist China officers training compound. And so these guys got to walk around this thing every day, you know. But it's here, and it's still intact. Interesting kind of a tribute to these very gifted men of God. All right. This was a strange history in China. This is a statue built in the honor of a man, you all recognize the name, Hong. Mr. Hong, if you know Chinese history at all, you have perhaps heard of the Taiping Revolution. This was a revolution back in the mid-1800s, which was, in terms of religion, it was a Christian heresy, but distinctly Christian. This was a man who had received training from Christian missionaries who had continued to use Christian missionaries as counselors. He considered himself, as a little later on toward the end of the revolution, considered himself the younger brother of Jesus. And that's where some of the heresy came about. But interesting kind of a thing, and what's really strange is that the Western nations, primarily England and France and Russia, somewhat the United States, they just weren't as strong in China at that time. They really felt that they would rather have that weaker monarchy in Peking than have this people's government here. And so they united to fight this the movement that this man represented, and it failed. Interesting experiment in history, though. Had it succeeded, the whole history of the world and the history of the Christian mission really would have been changed significantly. Anyhow, this is a whole museum built in this man's honor. But, okay, go ahead. The communists still revere him because he represented a people's movement against the nation. This is one of the churches in China. Nothing special about it except that it's really big. And it used to be used, this one, used to be used as a school auditorium during the Cultural Revolution, and since has been given back to the church, all right? This is in Shanghai, another monstrous church. These churches, we're talking about seating like 800 to 1,000 people or so, really big. And this particular church They have three or four services a weekend in order to accommodate the people that call this church home. Yeah.
Is this the official?
Yeah, three self movement church, right?
Okay. Did you get any data on home churches?
Very little, and the reason is because when you talk the home church or the underground church, by definition, it is something that is very secretive, and it just does not open itself up to long noses, which they call us. Long noses. Yeah. You know, anytime anyone like that would walk into a church like that, the whole church is exposed. And so it's really a difficult one for Westerners to get a handle on. Yeah, all you're going to see here is primarily three self-movement churches. Go ahead. Oh, yeah. Very definitely Christian. When you talk to the members, or even most of the clergy, I just really have the strong conviction that they are very definitely and committedly Christian. There's a lot of political pressure on this church, and that's one of their burdens, and they know it. But my feeling is that they see that as a burden rather than as a part of the gospel. Now, different people evaluate that different ways. This is taken inside of the first church that was opened up after the Cultural Revolution, Grace Church in Shanghai. Also seats 1,000-plus people. Beautiful, lovely church. Methodist by background. All right? This was a Baptist church in one of the smaller cities in China. And here you have depicted the River Jordan, and that leads up to, behind the altar area here, a little pool in which they can immerse people. Baptistry, thank you. My English power is very weak. And they offer that as an option for a form of baptism. Okay? This morning I preached here at Concordia Seminary. One other time I was invited to step into a pulpit in Nanking. And this is that occasion. I was part of a group of people from, I was one of six going in on that tour. The other five were all Hong Kong pastors. And church, as you can see here, was completely packed. I think the next picture also shows some of the people there. Go ahead. Looking out, pulpit is over this way. Looking out over the people here, my estimate is that there were something like 800 people or so in attendance that day. One of the most moving experiences I have ever had in my life, because you look out over the faces of these people and you can tell by their age that they are people who have lived through that cultural revolution, and they have really, as I mentioned in the sermon this morning, they have really suffered the worst that Satan could throw on a Christian, and they have survived it, and they are coming back to church in order to grow and to witness and to give their worship to God. And that I really had the feeling when I stepped into the pulpit, and it took a few swallows to get, you know, past that gosh, you know, I really feel like I don't have all that much to give to them, and I really wish that I could hear what they have to give in terms of their witness and their testimony. That was a special experience. Okay. In Mandarin. Yeah, in Mandarin. Well, yeah, it's kind of the dialect that is used by all of China. Now, there are regional languages, but Mandarin is kind of the national language in that sense. As I understand, and I have no way to trace that back, my being there at that time was probably one of the first occasions for a long nose to preach in a church in Mandarin that China has allowed since the Cultural Revolution. There have been a few others allowed to preach in English or speak or whatever, but this was one of the first in Mandarin, and that was special to me. This was last year, this year, May. This was in May, so a little less than about a half year or so ago. This is the major seminary in China, the Nanking Seminary. It's called Nanking Union Seminary, and it had been a union seminary before the communists ever took over there. Different churches combined together to one seminary. It is now the major seminary in the sense that it is the only seminary that offers a full 4-year post-high school curriculum. Now, that still doesn't match what we call for or what we demand in America for seminary training. But it is 4 years, in other words, comparable to university training. The other nine seminaries in China offer either a 2 or a 3 year curriculum. And the reason is because they are in such need of pastors or church leaders that they just don't want to wait anymore, and they want to have more people. But this one place is offers the full 4 year curriculum and then an MDiv, which they consider a graduate program on top of that. This seminary has about 160 students. The total seminary population in China is about 450, 500 or so. Yeah.
Are they open for non-novices to be able to teach at
nope.
the seminary?
Nope.
That's totally out.
Totally out. Totally out. The only thing I saw going on in China anywhere in a seminary was one long nose who was leading a kind of an English Bible study, which had the dual purpose of teaching Bible and teaching English, using the Bible to teach English and vice versa. And that was really not part of seminary curriculum, but it's the and therefore it was unofficial. Otherwise, there's just nothing there at this point. Now, I foresee maybe in another 2-3 years it's going to be open, but at this point, there's just not that option. Dr. G?
Nanjing?
Yeah, right, on this side, yeah. It says Nanjing University, Da Xue. Yeah, Religion Study Center. Well, what it means is that this is an area that, this is a place that is licensed to talk about things religious. Really, all they study is Christianity. But they have the two plaques here. One says Nanjing University, which this says here. The other you can't see as clearly. This says Shen Xue Yuan, the Nanking United Seminary. The faculty members are registered both as seminary professors and university professors. That's what that means. Okay. This is another smaller seminary, a regional seminary in Wuhan, much further down the Yangtze River from Nanking. Really, it's a church. It doesn't look like it, but it is a church in here, and part of the church is used as a seminary. Go on to the next one. I think that shows some of that. This is the classroom. This really was the first year they had been opened there. They had 40 students, and it really was a ramshackle-looking place. Just plywood walls here, just very bare. The floors were just planks is all they were. Desks here, just as bare as could be, and they had enough desks in the room to accommodate their 40 students. Go ahead. No. This is supported by the local church there. Now, they get donations, offerings. They also get rentals, and we'll talk about that in a minute, from properties that used to belong to the church and now are used by other units in China. We'll get back to that in a minute. Go ahead. Chris. This is the dormitory of that seminary. And I don't know the allocation, boys, girls, whatever, but you can see some of the clothes are hung out here to dry. And but there is a place for these students to live, and that's important because you got to have that in order to have food. All right? This is one of the saddest scenes I ever experienced in China. This is their library. I went in here. I asked to see their library because I was involved in theological education in Taiwan and knew a little bit about libraries, played with it somewhat. And so I was kind of interested to see what they had here. And all they had was a few newspapers and a few periodicals, magazines, not even theological, a few magazines stored up in here. Otherwise, they had nothing. Their faculty had nothing to use as resource materials, and the students had absolutely nothing to use. In other words, as a seminary, the one textbook they had was the Bible. That was it. Now, you know, the word of the Lord has its own power and all of that, and I believe that very strongly, but it's sure different from what we're used to in terms of theological education. It also is an indication of the fact that that cultural revolution, which ended little less than 10 years ago, really wiped out all theological literature in China. There just is nothing there. And one of the forms of input that we have, forms of help that we can give the church in China that they will allow and welcome, is theological literature in Chinese. And you can see the reason for that here. All right. These are a couple of the pastors in Hong Kong, and Raymond would recognize these fellows, and Tony Lau here. This is the principal of the seminary in Beijing, and one of the head pastors of the church there, some of the leaders. You can tell by the dress how different the Chinese from Hong Kong look from the different from the Chinese in the mainland. All right? This is the plant that's being built, and it should be completed by now, by the United Bible Society for the production of printing of Bibles in China. They have, according to their records, already printed and made available 2 million, something like 300,000 Bibles. But once this is put into operation, then they're going to have a lot more Bibles and hymnals and other literature, although technically this building is a joint venture between the Bible Society and Nanking University, which means that part of the production time will be assigned to ordinary university textbooks and so on. At any rate, this is an indication of the fact that China is opening up, though, and it's allowing this. Go ahead. There's a great man that most of you recognize. He is addressing the student body of the Nanking Seminary there. Dr. Bowman, right. And this is the president of the seminary, the acting president of the seminary there. That presence and visit was very well received, I should say. Okay, go ahead. All right, we're getting to the last few. This is a very nondescript-looking building, in a sense, and it's got the red communist star here, which is the symbol of the Communist Party. This is a very significant building in terms of size. It's a big building, and is used presently as a kindergarten in one of the cities in central China. What makes it unique for our purposes is that this is the classroom building, chapel, administration building of our former seminary in China. This is it. Next few pictures will show a few other things about that, but you can see that it is still intact, and it's in good shape. I mean, the communists took over in 49, and I don't know when this thing was built, but it had to go 20, 30, 40 years before that. So it's really in good shape, and it's being used, and it's in fact houses the finest kindergarten in this rather significant city in central China. And the kids who come to this kindergarten are children of the communist cadres, which is the Communist Party officers in this city. Go ahead. This shows some of the former faculty homes used as classroom buildings primarily, and one of them, the fourth one down the line here, is used as an office building. You see some of the kindergarten playground equipment here. Okay. All right, before I get into this one, I will say that the irony of this whole thing is that communists took this over. That was back in 49, and they used this very beautiful campus as kindergarten and so on for their purposes. When, after the Cultural Revolution was over, when the government decided that churches should be reimbursed for whatever properties it cannot recover, then by government order, Red Chinese government order, this kindergarten had to include in its budget rent that it paid to the Christian church in China. That is, the school was serving the communist cadres, you know, the officers of the Communist Party of China, and here they're paying rent to the church in China, gratis, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. What a twist of history, and who else, you know, but the Lord could have pulled that one off. But gosh, it's one of the ironies that's at work there, and one of the indications of the fact that the ground rules in China are different than they used to be. This is the last slide, and this is a pastor there, Reverend Lee, and his wife. He's 70-some years old. Reverend Lee, I visited him on the trip that I made in by myself, and the reason I visited him is because he was one of the pastors of our Missouri Synod Mission back before 49. And he knew some of our former missionaries, like Dr. Suflo, who taught on the faculty here, and some of the other missionaries that had been in China. And a smile that came over his face when we started dropping those names and talking about the old times was really a joyful thing, because he just kind of had written the Missouri Synod off from his mind. You know, that had been, he'd been told that that was one of the enemies, and one of those part of that country, you know, that has nothing to do with China anymore. And to think that someone would know him and look him up and be able to convey to him a partnership in the gospel was something that, well, look at the smile. That was a heartwarming day. It was really nice. And that brings us to bottom line. China has come a long, long, hard road, and it's not over yet. But at least at this halfway point, one of the bottom lines is to say that the Lord has done things in China that no one could ever have dreamed of 10 years ago. Just no one at all. And the Lord's not done yet. And where things are going to lead, and how open China is going to become, what options that gives to Missouri Synod involvement in mission there in China is still premature to say, except that I am really going back to Hong Kong with a lot of optimism and a lot of enthusiasm, because I think the door is opening rather than closing there. And when you're talking about a billion people, boy, that's where you got to lay a few eggs anyhow. And now Raymond's going back that direction too. In a sense, he's in a little different situation than I am because of the different passports we carry. 1997, Hong Kong becomes part of China. What that does there is uncertain. But in the larger picture, I still feel China is really much more open now than it ever had been. The church there has a credibility and an integrity that it had never had before, in terms of being both Chinese and Christian. And I think China is going to have things to teach us and to share with us in future years, maybe more so than we have to share with them. Well, enough for that. I entertain any questions you have for anything.
Can you bring books from Hong Kong to China?
Sure.
There are many theological books in Chinese in Hong Kong and Taiwan.
Right.
How many can
you? All right. Can I hardly ask you for a cup of coffee? Yeah. In fact, every time we go into China, we take some books like that, whether Bibles or really not so much Bibles because they have those available, but English Bibles, and there's a great demand for that, or other theological resources. And one of the things that I made a point to do when I was in China was to take, thank you, a list, a bibliography of books available in the Taiwan church market, and say to the church in China, look what's available here. If we can be of any help to get these to you, let us know. We'll be glad to do that, both Roman Catholic and Protestant. And I think that's one of the things that an American church can do, can kind of help unite those Chinese in Taiwan with the Chinese in on the mainland. Well, yeah, there's a restriction. If you use some discretion and don't carry too many in, or duplicates of the same kind of books and so on. I know I sent one of the projects we as a family made in China as a result of our visit to that seminary that had no library there, and talking with the faculty, was her request, the professor's request, was for English Bible resources. So what we did was to buy a bunch of English Bible portions printed by the Bible Society. And then as a family project, we recorded that on tape so that they had something to listen to, you know, in terms of pronunciation and so on. And we sent that in. We sent it in with a fellow who was studying at the university in that same city. About two-thirds of his books were confiscated. But that was because he was carrying like 50 portions of that New Testament portion. The rest were got in, and the next time he went in, he took a bunch more, and it, you know, no big problem. Other questions? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, where does that really lead us right now to our graduating next couple of years?
Well, what I'm going to say is going to sound kind of flip, and, you know, don't write some of that off with a little grain of salt. If you don't have a few gray hairs in your head, forget it. The Oriental culture is built on the assumption that you really don't have much to share until you have tasted a good bit of life yourself. And a bunch of young bucks that are coming out, you know, learn something first. Now, that's a crude way of saying it, but I think it's a realistic way of saying it. At the same time, I think in terms of overall strategy, I think one of the things that could be a very live possibility would be to say, all right, what we want to do as Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is to train a core of people who can minister to Chinese people. Now, forget where they live, Chinese people. And that can include the mainland, it can include Taiwan, Hong Kong, Singapore, Malaysia, Thailand, Philippines, Brazil, United States, Canada, wherever. Train a core of people who can minister to, who have the interest in, and have developed the language and cultural skills to deal with Chinese people. Then when you've got your feet wet and you know the language and, you know, you're ready, and there is an opening, we can say, hey, Chris, tomorrow we need you over there in Shanghai, and you're ready to go. To wait until we have an opening and then try to recruit people, I think, is just really a wrong-headed way to do it. To train people first may mean we end up training more people than we need, but gosh, one message I got a week and a half or so ago when I was here in a meeting of Asian ministers in the States was that, gosh, we don't have anywhere near enough here in the United States for crying out loud, much less overseas. So if you've got an interest, go for it. Really, go for it. This world is so small, and the need is so great, and the doors are going to open in such unexpected ways that I would say that's, you know, you really ought to go all the way for it. And even if you never get into a 100% Chinese ministry, you get into a campus ministry, you get into almost any kind of an urban ministry, my gosh, you're going to be equipped to deal in ministry in ways that are going to open doors you never believed before. I just really very deeply feel that. Yeah. Yeah.
Language and all that.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you need to gain cultural experience to understand how to do that. And if you're really interested in Chinese culture or Oriental, you have to be there, right?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of something did you do between, you know, say you graduate from seminary and maybe you take a, you know, you get a call to a parish for a couple of years to get your basis?
Yeah.
But after that, then if you're interested in continuing, would you
Well, that would be an option. One other kind of option is a program our Missouri Synod has had going for several years, both in Japan and in Taiwan. It's called the Volunteer Youth Ministry Program. It's a program for college-graduated people, not necessarily seminary-graduated, but it could be. In fact, some of the people that have gone through that VYM program have come to the seminary here and then gone back over that way. That's one option, to really open yourself up to another culture like that, whether it's Japan or China. Another option is if your call would ever involve itself in an urban situation here in the States, to tie up with what's called an ethnic ministry or a Chinese ministry here. We have 10 Chinese pastors in the Missouri Synod. That kind of surprised me. I guess at the same time I was both disappointed and surprised at that number. And they're in New York, and they're in Chicago, and they're in Frisco and L.A., and maybe that's about it. There are a few other ethnic groups represented in different areas. But that's another option to pursue, to get to know those people and to work with them somewhat. A big item on their agenda was discussing bicultural ministries in a congregation here in the States. And it may be Chinese, or it may be Laotian, or Hmong, or Vietnamese, or Korean, or, you know, any number of different things. That's another way of opening yourself up to another culture like that. So there are different avenues that can be explored. Yeah.
I have my hand up. My question was basically the same as his. I guess I would ask him that you're saying then that the individual has to take the initiative on his own to get this kind of thing.
Well, what I'm saying is if you have this interest, there are ways that you can develop it. Now, you put the question that way, and I guess I don't tell Dr. Westcott I said that because he's my boss, but I think you're probably right. I think the Missouri Synod is really not geared very well to opening up this kind of experiential program to a wide segment of our clergy or even membership. But it's going to come. And one of the things on my agenda, I have been appointed to this China Coordinating Center. One of the top priority things that I came back to the States on home leave with was communicating to people, whether it's the mission board here or Chinese pastors in the States or anywhere else, that you've got to think of Chinese ministry or any other kinds of ministry, whether it's Korean or anything else, in global terms and not geographical terms. Chinese are Chinese wherever they are, and the networks of kinship and family and so on, they stay. Even though you've got some people in the States here, and you got some people in mainland of China, in the boonies somewhere, and you got some people in Singapore. But the kinship is there. And we need to have the coordination and the cooperation and a global coordinated strategy that can take advantage of that. And so I think the kind of training that we're talking about or exposure, that's going to come. I really think so. I think another thing that's going to come is opportunities for more short-term types of ministry, not necessarily committed to 50 years of overseas ministry somewhere, you know, where you get forgotten about or airplane tickets never reach you or something, but a short-term kind of thing, year and a half, couple years, 2.5 years, whatever. Where you can do something, maybe even without the pain of learning a language, but you get your feet wet, and you learn some people, and you learn some culture, and then you're in a position to say, hey, that's what I think of as a satisfying kind of ministry. And one of the guys we have in Taiwan now is one who had been a volunteer youth minister. Another guy who is in Taiwan is married to a wife from Hong Kong, and so his feet got wet through marriage rather than through his own experience, but Lord works in those ways. The opportunities, I think, are going to become more and more available. You had your hand up.
I was just going to say, I think some of the best takes are the men who do develop and train themselves for particular fields. Sometimes to have a structured, developed program that the church pays for, simply doesn't reap the benefits as the pastor who's sitting in South Dakota and says, you know, there's an Indian reservation over here and nobody's taking care of them, and I'm going to learn that. I won't get anything out of it, but I just want to do it.
Yeah.
And before you know it, he has a whole web of relationships and knowledge that the Lord simply takes and multiplies the 12 loaves to 5,000 people and just keeps going. And that's where I think some of us just have to take the initiative.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Lord will use what training.
Sure.
Even little things, taking trips to China, you can do that now 2 weeks at a time.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big piece of it. You can visit and actually participate in workshops and seminars in the United States and foreign languages and cultures.
I'll tell you another option when you get to be a pastor in somewhere, Iowa. A lot of pastors lead tours to here and there, Holy Land or Germany, wherever, or Far East. One alternative kind of tour is a mission tour. That deals not so much in tourist types of sites, although that's part of it, but really deals with what's our church doing overseas, and what are the mission opportunities that are there, who are the people we're working with, and so on. And there have been a lot of those kinds of tours that have come through Hong Kong or Taiwan, and some then that have gone into China, and I think that's another way to get your feet wet and educate. Yeah, Dr. G.
Now, my question is, do we have, you know, I think this literature or the books
mm-hmm.
or seminary,
mm-hmm.
to me, that is a very vital area.
Yeah.
Now, do we have in our agenda of LCMS some kind of vision, you know, what to do about that? Not just getting a few books when you go there, but more substantial contribution. I just wonder. Now, several years ago, I wrote in fact, a memo to about the Luther Project, you know, which I have been engaged in the last 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it is a golden opportunity to invest 10 years of time, let us say, or with us. We have some talent here in our division. And then we will continue and penetrate into the theological area rather than waiting for somebody to produce and then we use their books. And then. I just wonder, when do you have that on your agenda?
Yeah. One of the things that is high on our priority list is a series of translation projects that we have already begun on. Now, one of them is getting a translation of the Book of Concord, which had been done by a missionary, into good Chinese, modern Chinese. And that's in the final stages now. We've got another couple of books that are in the final stages of translation. Paul Wang. I hate to say Wang because it is not the way Chinese say it, Wang, who graduated here last year. He and his wife are pretty much involved in those projects. And we've got another list of books that we're working on. So literature, intentional projection of what we consider good contributions to the overall theological scene of China is part of our strategy. Yeah. Now, Luther's works is something we're still negotiating on. Luther's works are very limited in Chinese. There are only two volumes. Two volumes, yeah. They're very...
Not just our denominational use, you know, like Concord.
Right.
I know that's top priority, I know that. But, like the Lord and Gospel, even that is also good. But
sure.
I'm thinking about the much wider area so that our Lutheran literature would be used as a clearly required text.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Now, there is a lot available already, and I'm thinking in terms of biblical study helps, commentaries, and that kind of thing, or systematic helps, too. It's a matter of updating some of those. It's a matter of putting some newer things, or some things that aren't in Chinese, making them available to the church there. Raymond?
Thank you.
denominational article and theological book. Because once if they run into again the resolution movement, then they may label some kind of you are American. Or,
yeah.
You know. So I don't know, but I just whether you know or not. So they may have some kind of they need books, but some kind of the denominational theological book.
Right. Well.
Kind of like English, you know, in China they really don't like Lutheran, as I learned from this thing, you know, because at first they misunderstood the peasant war. They thought
the peasant war, yeah.
You know, fight against the poor people, the neighbors, and protect the rich people. And the second issue is that the real presence of the body and blood of Jesus Christ, the Chinese think these people eat the blood and eat the meat of the people. How can you have that kind of theology? So I don't know. I just way mm-hmm. up here. Because I don't know. Can we give them such a denominational book? I just suspicious. They try to be no denominational any whoever identified.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I have felt is that while they have not a whole lot of use for Lutherans, just like they don't have a whole lot of use for other denominations, they do have a great fascination with Luther. And in fact, when I taught a course in Hong Kong on Luther's theology, Pastor Hung, he showed me about 3-4 different books that had been published in the mainland, in Chinese, on Luther. What else more than there is in Hong Kong or Taiwan on Luther? Unbelievable. So there's a, you may be right. You know, Luther was a strange guy. And you get fed up with him, and you get disgusted with him, and at the same time you get turned on by him. And I think that's true of Chinese too. And one thing that attracts Chinese to Luther is that he's so down to earth. He is really an earthy guy. He just really is. And I think that's one of the things that when we talked with Bishop Ding and some of the others, conversation very quickly centered more on Luther than on Lutheranism. Fine.
Yeah, I'd like to say, yeah. I think it's all great, man, because this is that's why, in the long run, the Jewish Synod, including the Jewish Synod and other Lutherans in this country, they really like to do that. They have to train the Chinese.
Yep.
Who will write and who articulate their
right.
Their own language.
Right.
They have to translate it from American
right.
or British or German.
Right. And several generations of work.
Of course.
Yeah.
Now that's why, not just 1 or 2 years of plan, but I mean, coming, let us say, 3-4 decades.
Yeah.
I think Luther, I think absolutely correct. In Korea, same thing.
Yeah.
If you come into certain doctrines, people naturally take teachers.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The interest, general interest of Luther is tremendous.
You yeah.
sell 98%, 99% of all production, you know, to learn Luther.
Yeah. Yeah. I really wish we were as advanced in the Chinese culture as we are in the Korean culture with someone like yourself, Dr. G. When Raymond has his son studying here at the seminary, or when Peter Wan or, you know, have their son studying here, boy, then we're in a position where we're going to make that kind of inroad. But now we're just not quite there yet. Excuse me, Raymond. Yeah.
China just tried to take over Hong Kong. And a lot of newspaper printing, Monsieur Sinner, missionary, is a spy. They came from CIA. corrupt because they thought that all those missionaries are CIA. I don't know how they know it or is it the fact or I heard the rumor that some missionaries, they are FBI or something like that, and came back and report about the China, Hong Kong. So I just give you a fact that we must be very careful to approach to some kind of development into that kind of tricky situation in China.
Yeah.
I just give you some information. That's one of the reasons why the musician is partnership in Hong Kong. Not, I don't know how big it is to affect the people, but after 1967, after the newspaper printed in that way, a lot of people are in the ability of play.
What we'd like to do, if we could break in right here, some of the guys want to go study. They're just chomping us a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got this pot of coffee in the back that we'd like you to empty before you go, so that you're awake half the night or whatever. But we want to thank you, and those people who can remain and continue the discussion, especially also, I think what's important to us is getting a hold of what we can do right here in the St. Louis area and beginning to do it in terms of exposure to Korean groups, Chinese groups, groups of Sikhs or whoever. You know, we have so many people groups right here in the St. Louis area, and sometimes we think, oh, we should have a seminary extension out in L.A. where we could have our students truck them all out there or something, you know, and then they could be exposed to different cultures. We can do things in St. Louis that we're not at all doing with Muslim students at Wash U, and you know, we have opportunities here that we just haven't, I don't know, put our heads in gear to even consider, because like you say, we're not globally oriented yet, and we don't consider the world our neighborhood, and the responsibility then just doesn't, something doesn't click. We're monocultural in a pluralistic society. The seminary has been located on a huge mission field, some say sixth largest in the world in terms of Christless people, and we don't really know it. So we really appreciate your taking the time to do some thought opening, eye opening, ear opening, whatever, heart opening tonight. As you spoke, I thought of the Chinese in Madang and Wewak and Lay and Port Moresby.
Sure.
And any country in the world, you know, so that you say, well, where am I going to use this? I can't get into China. Well, how about New Guinea?
Yeah.
You know, and oh, that didn't dawn on me that there are Chinese in New Guinea. Lots of things. So, again, thanks, and again, thank you all for coming, and continue the discussion as long as you can, because I know it is indeed vital, and help yourself to those 20 gallons of coffee.